This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. This is your host, Charles Giuliani. Got an important guest this evening, Anna Baltzer. She's the author of Witness in Palestine. She's going to be sharing with us her experiences dealing directly with the Palestinians today. Not so much. She's dealing with the issue over here. But I don't want to be telling her story. I want her to do that. So with no further ado, let's welcome Anna Baltzer. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Charlie.
Yeah, tell us, Anna, how did you first get involved, and how long ago was it that you got involved with the Palestinians and their plight?
I was just realizing the other day that it's actually been now 10 years since I first traveled to Palestine in a way that where I realized what was happening around me. I'd been there before to Israel-Palestine on a Birthright Israel trip, sort of a propaganda tour for young Jews to garner support for Israel, but what happened is I was living in Turkey, and I love to travel, and I actually traveled through the Middle East, through Syria, through Lebanon, and eventually became friends with a family that turned out to be Palestinian refugees, and it was through my friendship with that family and eventually others that I started to hear a very different version of the history and present of Israel than anything I'd ever learned on my Birthright Israel tour or growing up as a Jewish American. And that prompted me to go, and I eventually worked with a group called the International Women's Peace Service, which was there to document the situation and to do accompaniment with Palestinians supporting nonviolent resistance to the occupation.
So initially, you really weren't aware of the real issues. You were going there thinking that, Israel was more the victim and the Palestinians were the aggressors.
That's certainly the perception that I had growing up, and when I went on Birthright Israel, this particular tour that I mentioned. Other than that, I was actually traveling elsewhere, and I was prompted to go back to see sort of the underbelly, to see the other side, because of these friendships with Palestinians. And so I went back trying, to open my eyes to see the realities, and what I found was very shocking. I found a system of complete segregation, of roads that are essentially Jewish-only roads where Palestinian Muslims and Christians aren't allowed to use them, a system of segregated legal systems, housing, schools, hospitals, Palestinians who've been forced off of their land, Palestinians who'd lost their homes, one thing after another that really exposed Israel for something I'd never known it to be. And I became very passionate about changing the situation here in the United States, knowing that it's actually our tax dollars that enable Israel to continue its discriminatory policies.
So that must have been quite an awakening. It certainly sounds like it's not anything like what you had expected.
Oh, yeah. No, it was life-changing. It was life-changing, yeah. But I was really very inspired. I think people sometimes maybe shy away from this issue, thinking that, it's very complicated or hopeless. And in fact, I really recommend people going and seeing for themselves, because I think what you'll find is, first of all, just how bad things are, but also an incredible, inspiring, growing, strong movement for justice. And that movement is very much led by Palestinians on the ground who are, for example, demonstrating, marching down to the land that has been taken from them by settlements or by a wall that Israel's building with our tax dollars, Palestinians who refuse to leave their homes and lands, Palestinians who insist on getting education, even though there are so many obstacles to them, all different kinds of resistance. And what you find really is something very inspiring. And so I've tried to bring that kind of inspiring, that inspiration that I took to work here in the United States, because if there's one thing Palestinians said to me, it was, go home, work in the United States to change these things, because it's your tax dollars that enable this to happen to us. And so I've worked very much over the past many years with an organization called the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. And most of what I work on is actually corporate accountability campaigns, campaigns in support of the Palestinian call that was made in 2005 for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel until it complies with international law. And this is something that Palestinian civil society has asked of us as the international community, that we end our complicity, whether it's purchasing a product that was made in a settlement built illegally on Palestinian land, or it's investing our tuition dollars at university, or our retirement funds, or the money at our faith-based institutions, to divest that money, to not invest in companies that are involved in the Israeli occupation. Or sanctions, of course, that we ultimately, of course, must change the policies of the U.S. government to no longer contribute to these things. So there's a really wonderful, growing, exciting movement here in the U.S. that I'm very involved in. And the URL for our organization is endtheoccupation.org.
Yeah, you're so right. It is a lot easier to fix things here for two reasons. Number one, this is the source of the problem here. You know, like you said, our tax dollars fund much of what goes on over there. But also, you're probably less likely to get run over by, an IDF bulldozer over here. I'm sure you know the Rachel Corrie story. You try to fix things there, and it's a lot easier for you to, wind up dead, basically.
Yeah, working over there, the issue of privilege is very stark. Palestinians, face incredible violence when they try to resist. One example being Palestinians who've been bulldozed as they tried to defend their homes. And in fact, an international young woman named Rachel Corrie, it was actually just 2 months ago that was the 10-year anniversary of her being killed with an American-made Caterpillar bulldozer, driven by an Israeli soldier as she tried to prevent a Palestinian family's home from being demolished. And yes, there's, this incredible violence. It is by and large targeting Palestinian people. It's much less common for internationals to be targeted. And it sort of exposes very much the racist elements of Israel's policies, that Israelis who go there, that people like me who are white, American who go there, the soldiers would say, hey, move out of the way. You're in my shot, almost sort of protecting me. And yet the Palestinians, innocent Palestinian men, women, and children around me were being targeted simply because of their religious and ethnic background. And so it very much shows the racism underlying Israel's policies.
Now, have you lost any friends over this? Have you been called, the stereotypical name, self-hating Jew? Have you received that label?
Yes, at times. I have to say that that's sort of less and less common for some reason. I think one reason is that people are really waking up, that the younger generation of American Jews is increasingly aware and increasingly critical of Israel to varying degrees, not all as much as I am and in the same way that I am. Honestly, I think the term is losing perhaps some of its strength because it has been thrown around so much, the claims of anti-Semitism or being a self-hating Jew, used simply to silence legitimate criticism of Israel. And first of all, this like I said, it kind of removes any potency from the term that should describe things that are actually very serious. Anti-Semitism does still exist, as do other kinds of bigotry, and we stand firmly opposed to all types of bigotry, whether it's anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and anything like that. But what's really shocking about this is, if you dig a little bit deeper and you sort of dissect it, what does it mean when you say that protesting human rights abuses is protesting Judaism? Occupation and oppression, discrimination and racism, these things have nothing to do with Judaism. And to speak out against them is in no way anti-Jewish. And so really it's when people make this kind of parallel, it's very damaging. It's very, in my mind, anti-Semitic in itself. And I think people are waking up to that fact, and the opposition is scrambling a bit because the old tactics aren't working anymore, because the movement is getting stronger, and it's an exciting one that I always invite people to join.
Now, you said that you think a lot of, you know, young American Jewish people are starting to wake up. How about in Israel? Do you think there's such an awakening taking place there as well, or no?
Well, there have always been Israelis standing in solidarity with Palestinians. For example, there are Israelis today who are part of the Boycott From Within group. So this is a group of Israelis, largely Jewish citizens of Israel, who support the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. And they do so, I believe, from a very righteous standpoint of supporting the three goals of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which is known as BDS. They do so by supporting the goals of the BDS call, which are freedom, justice, and equality. That's freedom from occupation for Palestinians who are living in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, which were occupied by Israel in 1967, and also for the other segments of Palestinian society that oftentimes are forgotten. So you have Palestinians, for example, inside Israel, who are discriminated against, who do not have equal rights, who are non-Jews living in a state of the Jewish people. You know, what does that mean for them? It's not a state of its citizens that protects them, but a state of Jewish people, and they're not Jewish. And the third goal of the BDS call, the first one, end to the occupation, second one, equality for Palestinians in Israel, and the third one, the right of return for Palestinian refugees who were exiled 65 years ago this month, in Israel's creation. More than 750,000 Palestinians were violently removed from their homes and their lands. More than 500 Palestinian villages were demolished. This is in late 1947 and 1948 in Israel's creation, because in the land where Israel was to be created as a Jewish state, the majority of people weren't Jewish. And so creating a Jewish majority, an artificial Jewish majority, required the removal of and eternal discrimination against non-Jews. And the millions of descendants of these people in exile continue to live as refugees in exile, denied their inalienable right to return home. So to get back to the Israelis who support them, we very much support the BDS call and the rights associated with it, and there are Israelis who do as well, who support Palestinians, who march alongside them at demonstrations, et cetera. I would not say that certainly not all parts of Israeli society. There are many Israelis who move into settlements, Israelis serving in the army in very brutal ways, Israelis who are complicit in all different ways with the system. And even, I have to say, much of the Israeli left has basically a sort of a point at which they go no further. For example, opposing the occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, but saying nothing about the rights of Palestinians inside Israel and nothing about the refugees who are actually the majority of Palestinians, and their rights matter as well. So there's sort of varying degrees of sympathy, let's say, within Israeli society, and I wish those furthest left were more, but they're very powerful, or very their voices are loud for their small numbers, and they certainly play an important role in the struggle and in solidarity.
That's really good. So you're overall feeling hopeful for the future.
I do. I mean, I'm an organizer, so I sort of can't help but have some hope. I see the way that this movement is building. You know, I see the way that 6 years ago, when I began to give lectures around the United States, the hecklers that I got and the kinds of questions people asked, the skepticism with which I was received, the complete lack of knowledge among people about about what was happening. You know, all of these things are changing. We see more and more in the media. We see in sort of public discourse that people are increasingly aware of what Israel's doing, that it's not okay, and that we have to do something to stop it. What's very interesting is to see that Israel and its supporters, the establishment that is trying to support the status quo, what their reaction has been. And so now, as the perception of Israel has changed from one, you know, that Israel is somehow angelic, to one that Israel is doing terrible things, there's actually sort of a new strategy that's to say, well, it's not that Israel's perfect, but it's very complicated. You know, everyone's suffering. Nobody's really wrong. You know, everyone's done things that they're not proud of. And really, you know, let's just try and listen to each other and learn to coexist. And this is actually a very damaging
strategy. Like a whitewash.
Exactly. That's exactly what the word that I would use. And it's very insidious. It's very tempting and palatable, I think, to Western audiences that have been taught that somehow the problem is not oppression and, you know, institutionalized racism and colonial structures, but sort of a lack of understanding and a lack of compassion and listening for one another, that simply Israelis and Palestinians need to be friends, their children need to play together, they should, you know, trade their stories and light candles and hold hands and sing Kumbaya. But the fact of the matter is those children that play together, one grows up to be a soldier, and one grows up to be completely at the will of that of the other. The Palestinian grows up to be at the will of the Israeli soldier, to likely go to prison as a political prisoner or be shot if they tried to resist. You know, you couldn't. Nobody would take anyone seriously in the abolitionist movement if they said, "Now let's just bring together slaves and their masters and help them, you know, listen to each other more and agree to coexist," without talking about slavery. And many of these sort of projects of dialogue and coexistence that sort of avoid talking about the structures themselves that prevent coexistence are very damaging, and actually they are part of the boycott call, is to boycott these kinds of projects, because they're oftentimes actually part of a very calculated and explicit project. It's called Brand Israel. It was conceived by an Israeli think tank that basically Israel's image is getting bad, and so we have to divert attention away from Israel's policies towards Palestinians to its nicer sides. And so, so actually, now I'm getting into yet another layer. And oftentimes, what's being projected is not only these kinds of dialogue things, but actually showcasing, let's say, Israeli academic successes or technological achievements. I don't know, cultural achievements. And these are oftentimes used really insidiously, you know, cynically to whitewash Israel's crimes. You'll see something actually use the word whitewashing. There's some creative wording coming out in the movement, for example, pinkwashing. And pinkwashing, if you haven't heard it, is what's used to refer to when Israel uses gay rights in Israel, and you have these sort of events that showcase what a you know, a haven Israel is for gay and lesbian communities, LGBTQ communities, used as a way of falsely projecting Israel as a sort of progressive democracy, because it's not. It's in no way, shape, or form a progressive democracy. What happens to Palestinian queers? If you have groups like Palestinian Queers for BDS that say, "What about us? I mean, are you kidding me?" So anyway, we're very much noticing, and I'm very, you know, interested in the way that the opposition has changed precisely because of the impact that the movement has had on the discourse. And it shows that we have power, that we, you know, people of conscience around the world, we don't have the, you know, billions of dollars of you know, political strength or corporate strength, but we're everyday people, and we have justice on our side, and we can see through, you know, through the headlines in Israel, through slowly but surely boycott, divestment, and sanctions victory, that that we have an impact, and that our movement can't be stopped.
Excellent. You know, most Americans, as I'm sure you're aware, just aren't really aware of what goes on over there. You know, what the real plight is that the Palestinians face every day. In fact, quite to the contrary, Most Americans think that, you know, the Israelis are the victims most of the time. You, of course, who have been over there and witnessed firsthand some of the things that go on, it's always good to get a first-person perspective on this. What are some of the things that you yourself personally have witnessed that convinces you that, you know, it's just not the way we're being told?
Right. So, yeah, I sort of didn't get too much into that. I mean, I mentioned the utter segregation, the fact that you have segregated roads for different parts of the population, where basically Palestinians who in the area are predominantly Muslim or Christian have one set of rights, while Jewish Israelis who have moved into the West Bank have another. I was living in the West Bank, and I'll describe some of the things I saw in the West Bank, but it's also important that I mention what happens in Gaza and Israel and even refugees. But to talk about my own personal experience, so I was living in a little village in the West Bank, and we saw, with every passing day, settlements being built all around this little village on land belonging to my friends, my neighbors, their families, land that belonged to them for generations, land that they had cultivated, all of trees that were like part of their family. And what's happening is that actually Israel is paying its own citizens in many cases to move on to Palestinian land in the West Bank, to move into what are called settlements, communities of Jewish Israelis built illegally on land that is internationally recognized as Palestinian land. And, you know, this sounds maybe a little hard to conceptualize unless you sort of look at it in the context of history. I mean, I'm not sure that this is something new. The idea of a foreign country going into another land, pushing off the indigenous population, and building towns and cities for its own civilian population.
Literally stealing their land.
Literally stealing their land. This is not something only Israel has done. It's happened throughout history. It's happened around the world. It's happened right here. And there's a word for it. It's called colonization. And what we see is the increasing colonization of the Palestinian West Bank through Israel's occupation of that land, and has occupied it since 1967. So for a very long time, this is not a temporary occupation. So you have these settlements that are growing with every passing day, literally, you know, dotting the entire area of the West Bank. You can't hardly look in any direction without another settlement coming into view. And Palestinians, meanwhile, being squeezed into these tinier and tinier ghettos, basically. You know, you could compare them to reservations. You can compare them to Bantustans in apartheid South Africa. In fact, many South African leaders in the anti-apartheid movement, including the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, including Ahmed Kathrada, who was imprisoned alongside Nelson Mandela, with whom I've been in contact because he just recently returned and has been helping us with a campaign that I could tell you about, have compared what's happening in Israel-Palestine with what happened to them under apartheid rule in South Africa, in many ways calling it worse than what they experienced. So you have, you know, Palestinians being, you know, squeezed into these Bantustans, unable to move, unable to reach their lands, separated from one another, separated from their schools, their jobs, their livelihoods. You know, every aspect of life is paralyzed by this kind of a structure. And as you try and move from one place to another, there are checkpoints, not checkpoints between Palestinian towns and Israeli towns, but literally checkpoints throughout the West Bank, throughout Palestinian land, between Palestinian towns and villages. So if you're a Palestinian living in a village and you want to go to university in a nearby city, it could take you 2 hours, it could take you 6 hours, it could take you 10 hours to get to where you need to know to go. You couldn't be sure you could get back home. What if you're a mother and you can't be sure you can get back home to your kids after work? People oftentimes are unable to hold a steady job, to get an education. And what's quite extraordinary is that in spite of all of these obstacles, Palestinians continue to have a very thriving educational system and a real commitment to education that has always really made an impact on me when I was there. The reverence that Palestinians, my Palestinian friends have to education. So, you know, we've talked about the settlements, you know, there's these checkpoints all over that prevent everyday life. And then you have something known as the apartheid law. And this is a, in many areas, a 25-foot concrete wall. If you can imagine that, we're talking about twice the size of the Berlin Wall in concrete. It is hard to imagine unless you're literally looking up at it, gaping at it, towering over you. And this is a wall that is being built with U.S. tax dollars, with money that we give in military and economic aid to Israel.
And that's now. What makes this all the more disgusting, because there's our government claiming to be against human rights abuses and actually invading countries over things like this. And yet they not only turned a blind eye to this, but they literally are supporting this very kind of thing with our tax dollars.
Exactly. And I don't think the irony is lost on people in the Middle East who hear us talking about democracy and yet funneling seemingly endless amounts of dollars to and weapons to Israel. And absolutely, I mean, this sounds sometimes like something happening on the other side of the world, but we're paying for it. This is something very much close to home. This is something, you know, at a time also, and given our economy right now in the U.S., you know, how else could these tax dollars be spent? You know, don't we have community needs here? Why are we giving all of this money to be used against the Palestinian people by Israel? So absolutely, and that's one of the main focal points of the organization I work for, again, the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, endtheoccupation.org, is knowing our, you know, primary role as Americans to change all forms of U.S. institutional support for Israel's occupation and apartheid policies, you know, top of the list being, of course, ending U.S. military and economic aid to Israel. And we've been campaigning for that for more than a decade. So absolutely, this, you know, everything that I talk about has to be seen through that frame. That we, there, you know, the idea that people have that they don't want to get involved. You know, I hear that all the time. Oh, it's too complicated. I don't want to get involved. We are involved. If you are paying taxes, you are already involved. You have no choice of being not involved. Either you're involved in a negative, damaging, destructive way, or start getting involved in a productive way. And that's what we're trying to help people to do. So, yeah, so this wall weaving deeply into the West Bank, further cutting communities off from their lands and from their schools and their jobs, et cetera. And parts of it are concrete. Parts of it are a wire fence reinforced with heavy-duty electric sensory wire, razor wire.
Very reminiscent of the Berlin Wall.
Absolutely. Exactly. And, you know, sometimes people, I haven't heard this in a while, but used to say it's a fence. And, you know, fence with you know, electric sensory, razor wire, thermal imaging, sniper towers. This is the kind of, quote, fence that surrounds prisons in the United States, not the kind of, you know, picket fence we have in our backyard. And, you know, speaking of prisons, there are many parallels with the treatment of Palestinian political prisoners and the treatment of people here in the United States, whether it's immigrant communities or other communities of color. We see as we try to, you know, explore and implement corporate accountability campaigns that there are companies actually that are working both here in the U.S. and in Palestine, furthering oppressive racist policies in both places. G4S, for example, is a private securities company that works that is part of Israel's industrial prison complex, where it imprisons Palestinian political prisoners, thousands of them, people who oftentimes have been resisting nonviolently and are put into prison simply because they're resisting the system. There are also very similar contracts between those held by Israel with G4S and here in the United States with U.S. prisons. There are so many points of connection, and I think people are starting to make those connections to see, and maybe not starting, have been maybe for a long time, seeing this struggle within the broader context of anti-racism, of working for global justice no matter where. And so these links are made, and, you know, in hearing from people like the Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Ahmed Kathrada, the parallels made that this is not that this is something we've seen all over the world and something we need to work together, all peoples, to stop.
Absolutely. I tell you what, we got to cut to a break. We got some callers, though, waiting on the line. When we get back, we'll get to them. They got some questions for you. So stick with us, folks. We'll be right back with our guest, Anna Baltzer, again, the author of Witness in Palestine. We'll be right back.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana. And it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. And learn how you can help. Go to normal.org.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. When I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
Come, you masters of war.
Hello, this is Cindy Sheehan. America's war on terror has become a war of terror, with endless drone bombings, continuing military occupation, as well as detention, rendition, and torture still being practiced under the current administration. I lost my precious son Casey to war, and now work towards a day when not one more mother, son, or daughter will suffer such a loss. Listen to my podcast, read my blog, and come join me at any activities I attend near you. Please visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com for more information, and let's work for peace together.
Build, destroy.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests from various realms of interest share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Again, our guest is Anna Baltzer. She's the author of Witness in Palestine. We've been talking about the plight of the Palestinians and what she has been doing to help turn that situation around. We do have a couple callers on the line in this second half here. We also got some questions coming in via text we'll get to later, but let's go first to Nader in California. He's on line two. Are you there, Nader?
Yeah, I am, Charles. Hi, how are you?
How's it going?
Good, good. First and foremost, Charles, I want to say, Anna, God bless you for everything that you've been doing. Unfortunately, I missed the evening when you were here in California and you were at our church. I wish I would have been there. I love your book and I loved your CD, and I want to congratulate you on everything that you're doing. You know, my memories of Palestine when I was a kid, especially in the West Bank region, it was very, very beautiful, very calm, until the coming of the Israeli soldiers. And, you know, they were shooting at our feet. They weren't extremely nice people. I know that some of my cousins, the girls, as they were coming out of the schools, they were hit by 2x4s on their butts. What can we do more here in the, I want to say, internet world to, you know, produce more light to most Americans? Because a lot of Americans are actually, you know, nullified, and they don't know anything about what's going on because they're sheltered by the media here. And they're being trained in their churches that Zionism is the correct, way of doing things, and that's the way that things are supposed to go in a biblical fashion. But you and I know that that's not correct. How can you shed some light on this, please?
Sure. So thank you for calling, and thanks also for sharing your story from Palestine. I think there are definitely ways of helping to educate people, but there's a bigger point that I'd like to make. But before that, you have DVDs like Occupation 101, Roadmap to Apartheid. I have a DVD, Life in Occupied Palestine, and it's on my website, AnnaInTheMiddleEast.com. PalestineOnlineStore.com has a lot of these. I think that actually more than anything else, what educates people and what endears them to this issue is Palestinian voices and meeting Palestinians like yourself. I recently was thinking a lot about the movement for LGBTQ rights and how for many years the movement was focused on trying to show people that gay marriage was an equal right. And it turns out what really moved people was that they had a gay brother, or a gay daughter, or a gay friend, or a gay neighbor, that those relationships oftentimes are what make change. And I think a very positive thing that's happening throughout the movement in the country is that Palestinian voices are increasingly being elevated and heard. And unfortunately, for many years, voices like mine have been privileged over voices like yours, Nader, that I, as a as an American Jew, am invited to speak at your church, for example, and invited to to tell my story, to tell your story, basically. And oftentimes Palestinians aren't invited to tell their own stories. They're seen as subjective or angry, or it's absurd. Imagine during the feminist movement, if someone wanted to hear men talk about feminism because women were too angry. it's laughable now, but so there's been a real issue of I think privilege in the movement, and I think it's changing, and I think it's a very positive change, first of all, within the context of the struggle for anti-racism, that we believe that Palestinians have a right to self-determination and their voices being heard, and also that it's strategic. So I encourage you, Nader, to tell your story, and I think it is your voice ultimately that will be more powerful than mine. But I have a bigger point I want to make, and that, if I haven't been speaking too long already to your question, and that is that I think that there is the question of education and there's the question of mobilization. And I have to say that I dedicated 5 years of my life to educating people, and that was actually the easy part. People at the end of the talk said, oh, this is awful, what can we do? And the question is how to answer that. And I believe that to make change throughout history, it's never been consensus or even a majority, but it's been a critical mass of people that have forced change to happen. And I think that we're at that critical mass, that if everybody who's already sympathetic were to take action, to get involved in campaigns, not simply watching films or talking about the issue, but actually actively involved in campaigns, we could make a real difference. And the work that They talk about the critical mass. And for years, I was almost only giving presentations, and I intentionally left because I wanted to answer that question what do we do now that we're sympathetic? And that's what the organization I work for, the U.S. Campaign Debt and the Israeli Occupation, works on with many, many organizations around the country. In fact, we're a coalition of more than 400 groups. And at the very minimum, people can go to our website and join our email list. You can go to endtheoccupation.org. And we send out, we try to keep appraised of what's happening in the movement, of different campaigns going on, of things that everyday people can do. Oftentimes they are online. They're signing a petition or an action alert or, through Facebook or Twitter. I don't want to say that is the only thing people should do. I think oftentimes it also involves getting out on the streets, going to meetings, grunt work, et cetera. At the very least, people signing up and learning a bit about what's going on, and you might find your niche. You might find that there's something that you want to get, sink your teeth into. And there are a lot of campaigns happening around BDS the Palestinian Call for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. For example, there are people who are organizing campaigns targeting SodaStream, which is a product made in an Israeli settlement that turns tap water into soda water. There are campaigns, I'm not sure if you're in Northern California, but there's a group there that's campaigning against Hewlett-Packard, which provides technology to Israel used against Palestinians, used in the occupation, getting people to pledge not to buy HP products anymore.
Wow, I didn't know that.
to leadership. I mean, I have a whole list here I could read from, but I want to give other callers a chance. The main point I want to make is that, yes, educate people and let your voice be heard, because you are the expert, not me, as a Palestinian you are the expert. And also know that you don't have to convince every person. And oftentimes we waste our time on those who are least likely to become active in the movement. And we don't think of people who are most likely to, either those who are sympathetic but don't know what to do, or those who are natural allies, who are involved in other similar struggles, who might understand more clearly. And that's what allows me to be hopeful. If I'm not banging my head against the wall with a small minority of people who are most angry and opposed to what I'm doing, it's amazing what we can accomplish.
Sure. Maybe a mass emailing to Hewlett Packard. I didn't even know about that. Was that it, Nader?
No, I had another question, Anna. Like here online, we're usually in social issue rooms and stuff like that. The minute that we speak about Israel, we're labeled, we're slandered, we're harassed, we're told that we're morons, idiots, jerks, and everything else, and we spew hate towards Jews. Now, I know in your view, when we speak about Israel, it's the opposite. So I wanted to thank you once again very much. I don't want to take up too much of the time. I know there's other callers. And I also wanted to let you know that I am very familiar with the Omesh brothers, especially the editor of Occupation 101. Very, very brilliant guys, and you're very brilliant yourself, Anna, and God bless you. And, you know, hopefully we'll see a pre-Palestine.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the call, Nader. Let's go to our next caller, Tara in Georgia. Are you there, Tara?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Anna. How are you tonight?
All right, welcome to the
show. I'm good. Thanks for asking. I was just, you know, listening to you and being on, you know, being holding and waiting to talk to you. There's so many questions running through my mind right now. It's not even right. But, you know, you really do serve a great, great purpose. You know, what really got me was the fact that you said, you know, get together and get out and do something. You know, it's one thing to sit on the computer and do and talk and talk and do stuff, but get out. Let your voice be heard. And that's what I think is lacking with people today. They just talk about it instead of do it. You know what I mean? Do you know where I'm coming from?
Yeah. I do know where you're coming from, and I want to acknowledge that there are a lot of different ways of getting involved, and that they all have a place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, to speak directly maybe to your point, the idea, I think oftentimes that we don't know enough to get involved, or there's nothing we can do. What can I do as one person? That Palestinians have answered that question for us with their 2005 call for boycott, divestment, sanctions. This is something that every person can do. This is something where you and your, you know, the smallest community can begin to plan out a campaign, and that's exactly what I work on. And for those of you who are part
right.
of groups who want to do that, you can reach me at organizer@andtheoccupation.org. And exactly that if all the people who felt sympathetic were to do something, and sometimes doing stuff online is really helpful, so I don't want to diminish that. Ideally, it should be done in conjunction with even more, as much as people are able to do, given whatever, you know, their lives and limitations might be.
Was that it,
Exactly,
Tara?
Exactly. And I just wanted, a friend of mine in the room asked me this question, and I just wanted to know her view about it. Would you say that the Gaza Wall is compatible to the East Berlin Wall?
By the way, Tara, do you have either a TV on or your computer speakers? If you could turn them down, because there is a feedback.
And I heard her question, so I can repeat it. I heard her question.
You can go ahead.
So I think
I'm sorry. They were playing.
No,
they're on
no
my head,
problem.
My neck. I'm sorry.
No problem. So the wall, I think you'd asked about the wall in Gaza, and I'm not sure if you meant the one in the West Bank. There is a wall around Gaza, and I hardly talked about Gaza. In fact, thanks for reminding me. The Gaza Strip being an even tinier, small area of Palestinian land occupied in 1967. 1967, where Palestinians are enclosed with an actual wall, in fact, that many people don't know about, built by Israel, living in what many call an open-air prison or even an open-air sort of concentration camp of Palestinians who have been squeezed into this small area and are denied many of their most basic rights. And, you know, the wall around the Gaza Strip, I've seen it. I can't say that I know that much about what it looks like up close. I've seen it from afar, and I know that it, in fact, extends much even further than what it is. Oftentimes, you can't get within, let's say, meters or even miles of the wall, and so you can be shot if you are even close to it. So, in some ways, sometimes the wall is much bigger than it even looks because it extends so far. The wall in the West Bank certainly oftentimes is that way, where even more land is taken for the wall than you see when you look at the wall itself. And yeah, I think in many ways it is comparable to the Berlin Wall. If I knew more about the Berlin Wall, I might be able to give more specifics, but many have made that connection. It is, of course, in the West Bank, twice the size of the Berlin Wall. And the infrastructure is so much more sophisticated. Israeli apartheid is very sophisticated in many ways. And so in some ways it's even more horrifying to look at, not, of course, having been able to see the Berlin Wall when it was up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you so very much. And I've been reading, actually, I've been reading up on you for quite a while, and I'm so glad that you actually chose to take a stand. Because, like I said, a lot of people, you know, they just don't do it. And it's one thing to talk about it and another thing to actually take a stand and do it. And I appreciate you and appreciate what you're doing. And I just hope a lot of more people get involved with whatever they want in their own country. And I thank you so much for taking my questions.
Well, thanks for calling, Tara. All right. Let's see. We've got we got a few more minutes left here. We have a call that a question that has come in via text. This comes from Karen in New York, and she asks, "Does Anne feel that the American media and government are propagandizing the American people into thinking that Israel is a victim and Palestine is the aggressor?" We've kind of touched on that already, but did you want to elaborate on that some more? Or?
Sure. Yes, I think that the government and media are misleading the American public wildly. I mean, if you read articles, I used to, when I was working on the ground, I would be literally at a demonstration or literally at some sort of function or event, and I would read about it in the paper, and it would be just completely different from what I had seen with my own eyes on the ground. Unfortunately, you cannot trust the media on this and probably many other things. I have actually a very striking example I give in my DVD of a Newsweek issue where a friend of mine was flying back from Palestine to the U.S. and she picked up Newsweek on her way. It was in Germany. I think she had a layover. Picked it up, the Newsweek version that turned out to be the international version. She gets back to the U.S. She's flying through Chicago, picks up, notices, catches a ride that there's a Newsweek U.S. version there in one of the stores, and she compares the two of them, and in fact there was a cover story about called The Plight of the Palestinians, that was the name on the cover, and it had been completely removed from the U.S. version. It was right there on the cover of the international version, completely removed from the U.S. version, not just the cover, but removed from the entire issue of Newsweek that was given to Americans. So the whole world gets one, and the U.S., people in the U.S. get the other. We are not getting the full story. You can get the full story. I mean, you have incredible media outlets that are getting it out there. You have things like the electronicintifada.net. You have mondoweiss.net. You have lots of different sources of media that I encourage people to go to. And if you go to our website, andtheoccupation.org, you can contact us. I can give you others. Some might be listed there. There's no excuse for not getting the information, but you're not going to get it delivered to your doorstep through the mainstream media. And likewise, I mean, just listening to Obama today talking about defending Israel seemingly for anything that it does, we aren't getting the full story from our elected officials, and that is our responsibility to change. We can't wait for that change to come from them. Historically, social justice struggles have always been forced by the grassroots, and that's what BDS campaigns, that's what our activism, that's what we build. That's the pressure that we build from the bottom up. And eventually, there will come a time where the cost will be too great for supporting Israel, where it will be an embarrassment to continue to support Israel the way that we do. And that's when we'll see the change come. And it's time to stop, you know, asking for it or wishing for it or simply writing letters about it, but to organize. And that's what brings change, and that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, it is frightening, the pro-Israel influence in this country, the power that they exert. And of course, I'm sure you're aware of, you know, AIPAC. They play a big role in that. You know, very influential in Washington with the campaign contributions that they make. They're very well financially endowed. And so there's a definite inordinate influence there. And then, of course, you have, the Zionist-controlled media predominantly in this country. Plays a big role in that. Wouldn't you agree?
I'm not sure that I would phrase it that way. I think that there are probably a variety of reasons that that things are not portrayed correctly in the media, and I don't necessarily think it's sort of a full control by people who support Israel. There is certainly a lot of control. A lot of people who support Israel who have influence within the media. And there's also a lot of ignorance, and there's also a lot of, I think, pressure that happens behind the scenes. There is, you know, it's kind of a complex, I think, net of reasons that journalists are caught into, being guilt-tripped, being, called names, et cetera, things that have come up already on the show today.
Yeah.
And I think all of these factors contribute to it. But this is all, you know, this should not be demoralizing. On the contrary, this is a call to us. You know, we can affect the media. We're already seeing it. Never before had I ever seen this kind of coverage in the New York Times, for example, or the Washington Post or New York Times Magazine. We're seeing things we've never seen before, and that's because we're pushing. And that's what we have to do.
Right. We got another question here. This is Jack in Ohio. Again, it's kind of something we already touched on. I guess maybe he didn't tune in earlier on, but he asks, have you found many Israelis sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians, especially those in Gaza, or are they as unaware as Americans of the real situation?
So, I mean, I mentioned before sort of the spread of Israeli society, you know, some being aligned very much with what the sort of stuff that I'm doing and with what Palestinians are asking for, some being diametrically opposed, some only going so far. But you do bring up the question of, you know, do Israelis even know? And, you know, another image that I have in my DVD, as a matter of fact, is an image of the wall, the apartheid wall that I talked about, a 25-foot concrete wall, taken when I was inside the city of Qalqilya, a Palestinian city that is surrounded entirely by the wall, literally encircled by this wall. Imagine that for a moment. And I took I had a picture traveling by Qalqilya on the other side, on an Israeli highway, looking over to the West Bank, to where the wall is. And in fact, if you can imagine, the land had been built up to the wall so that it looked like a hill. You couldn't tell that there was a wall there. It was a hill that was covered with grass and some flowers. And if you'd gone up to the edge, you would have looked down, peered down 25 feet into the city of Qalqilya, but you didn't see it from the Israeli side. You would want to ask Israeli, you know, allies and activists for a more complete picture of what things are like in Israel. I certainly can't speak for what Israeli society thinks and knows. But I can tell you that much of it is shielded from the Israeli eye, and much of it, you know, Israelis are in many ways able to live a perfectly normal life and oftentimes a very privileged life and really not have to be bothered with what's happening sometimes a kilometer away from them. And that's really the sophisticated nature of Israel's apartheid system. Not totally unlike, by the way that we as Americans oftentimes can live oblivious to the disastrous things that we're doing to other peoples across the world. But perhaps it's even more striking when it's happening a mile away.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're just about out of time here. I just wanted to say one thing I've noticed is there seems to be more freedom in the Israeli press to criticize Israel than in our own, though. I've noticed quite a few critical articles over the years in Haaretz and Jerusalem Post, something that I really don't see in our own media here. Have you noticed that yourself?
Yeah, I have. You know, that Newsweek story, you know, Israelis got the Newsweek International one, as far as I know. Yeah, and it can be instructive to look at Israeli media. Israeli media does certainly, the mainstream media does have its limits, and oftentimes I can be quite critical of the Israeli media, but objectively speaking, they cover much more of the plight of the Palestinians than our media even, and
yeah.
People don't know that.
Very strange. Yeah, I've noticed that as well. Anyway, that is about all we have for time. I want to thank you again for coming on, Annie. You're doing a great work. I want to encourage you to keep doing it, and maybe we can have you on again sometime, and you can share some more of what's going on.
Thank you so much for having me, Charlie. It was a pleasure. And
you
once
bet.
Again, people can check out our work. I work for the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, and our website is endtheoccupation.org.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I totally forgot. My apologies. I meant to have you mention your website. So, yeah, definitely
no
go check
problem.
That out. Okay, you take care.
Thanks, Charlie.
You bet. Bye-bye. Okay, folks, that's it for today. Next week, join us. We're going to have Trayvon Martin's parents and family attorney, Natalie Jackson, going to be speaking about the George Zimmerman case. You don't want to miss that. It's going to be very revealing, very interesting. So have a great week, and we'll see you then. Take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office at summer people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land made for you and me.